We ended last week with the citation from Tosis and Tainus and Daftes about the schus of tzedakah. I want to tell you, share with you something from my personal experiences. The truth of the matter is, I should really have publicized this a long time ago. Because, as you'll see, if I publicized it, I'd probably have a long line waiting to give me tzedakah. The truth is, it's not me. It's the schus of the people that give the tzedakah. It's not my schus. A good number of years back, I have a chaver whose wife was very, very involved with Kura for Russians. This time of the year, Chodesh Adar time, and she wanted to make a, there was a Suda, Spurim going on the Kirov organization, and she had 100 people that she was involved with of Russian background that she wanted to bring to the Suda's Purim. And she went to the caterer and she asked him for his best price. So he said, listen, $7 a plate I could do it for you. You know, for a mitzvah, $7 a plate. She called me up. She was Chodesh Adar. I should help her get the money. So I said, call me back in a week. Well, half the week went by, I was busy. Came to Wednesday. So I asked someone I met in the morning, gave me $100. I met a chassidish, a friend of mine during the day, gave me $40. I came home. It's at night. I said, it's Wednesday already. You know, Sunday is looming. I better do something about this. So I decided I'm going to get on the phone. And I'll call the type of guys that were stocker or willing to, you would not be difficult for them to give me 100. And I said, that's, I'm going to get on the phone, and I'm not going to get off until I finish. I have to raise 560, and that's it. When I finish, I'll get off the phone. Pick up the phone, I call the first guy. Say, here's what I want. He says, Rabbi. He says, tell me. He says, how much money do you need? He says, well, I needed 700, and I got 140 today, so I need 560. He says, Rabbi, you have it. On me. Problem solved. This is on Wednesday. I meet the guy Shabbos. And he says, Rabbi, I've got to tell you the most phenomenal thing. Wednesday night, he called me, and I pledged $560 for your Kirov project. Thursday, a guy walks into my business. And a guy, he owed me money, but Hilchas Olam Mashiach, I never expected, I'm never going to collect. He walks in, and he peels off $5,600, and he pays me $5,600 on Thursday. Give the Meister Wednesday night, Thursday from heaven, $5,600 fell on him, and Friday night, I bump into him, he tells me the story. Rabbi said, that's the schus of tzedakah. Once in a while, the Gemara says in Tainus that normally we're not supposed to test the Rabbi Nishalayim. Except in one thing, in tzedakah, we can test the Rabbi Nishalayim. We can give and say, Rabbi Nishalayim, where's the bracha? I'm just giving you one example of the bracha that's associated with the schus of tzedakah. Now, I just want to make an observation. We started to talk about Meiser, about who was Mechuyev and Meiser, and then go into some of the broader details of the mitzvah. Who's Mechuyev to give Meiser? For Velvel, the Biskarov defined it very simply. If I'm able to give Meiser and support myself, I'm still able to pay the bills. So then I'm Mechuyev to give Meiser. If I won't be able to pay the bills if I give Meiser, so to whatever extent I won't be able to take care of myself, so to that extent I'm exempt. The problem that we have, and it's, I have no solution to this problem, is we have a different order of what we consider necessary to exist. 40 years ago, we didn't consider a lot of the things that we do necessary. Our parents would have thought we're out of our minds. And our grandparents couldn't even relate to us as Mishugayim. So we really, there's a measure of honesty that's associated with it. The Chofetz Chaim Zecher Tzadik Livracha in the Mishnah Berurah, where he talks about how much, what's our responsibility to our children? It's true, we want to do a lot, but what is our responsibility to our children? So he throws down a challenge, the Chofetz Chaim. And the Chofetz Chaim, as we know, was a very, very practical man. He was able to capture the heart of Klal Yisrael because people sensed about him that he understood the realities of life very, very well. The Chofetz Chaim writes, it's in the Mishnah Berurah, that what am I obligated to do for my children? It says, let me ask you the following question. Suppose the Beis Din in your city came to you and they said, Beryl, we have this Yosem here. There's nowhere to take care of him. So we looked around town. We decided you're the most suitable candidate. So we insist that you take this Yosem into your house. And that's it. And raise him until he's ready to go off in the world on his own. This is the best game in the world. Are you going to say no to them? That's it. That's what they want. So you undertake to do it. So the Chofetz Chaim says, you took a responsibility to give him what he needs. So what will you judge as to what he needs? And what will you say is excessive? And the Chofetz Chaim says, from that standpoint, we should judge what our obligations to our children are. Of course, every father would like to give more than he's obligated to give, more than the most basic things. But we need a certain sense of what the basics are so that we can evaluate in terms of our lifestyle what's truly necessary and what's not 100% necessary, what's not 95% necessary, so that we have a certain perspective on money which allows us to be able to be involved in stocker too. If I think I need 7 Porsches, parked in the driveway, so I'm going to have to make an awful lot of money to be able to afford 7 Porsches, the house that's going to accommodate them, and plus to give tzedakah. So the Chofetz Chaim gives us a sobering yardstick by which to evaluate what's necessary in life and what's beyond necessary. And as I say, there's no real solution to it because it changes constantly in every society and every circumstance in which we live. But we need a certain sense of what we need and what we'd like to have, and that will give us a better handle on what we do with the money that we have. Now, in a world where there's a lot of investment that goes on, in this United States, there's an awful lot of people that are in mutual funds, in the stock market, and other investment instruments. And it's any investment in the entire history of the world. Sometimes you make money and sometimes you lose money. So how do we evaluate that in terms of Meiser, how does that affect? In March, I made a killing. And in November, I lost a fair piece of money. Overall, I still made a profit, but nothing nearly what I did in March, when all the dust settles. So there's one balance off against the other. And before we go to a resolution of this problem, there's something else that we have to do. I talked last time about the fact when a person undertakes to give Meiser, that he should undertake it B'li Neder. It's a Minhag Tov, and I want to do it in B'li Neder, so that we don't get complications of it being a Din D'oraisa. The second thing that we have to do, every financial institution has to have a fiscal year. Could be the calendar year, it could be July 1st to June, whatever, but there has to be a fiscal year. And this is very, very essential, as we'll see. There are those among the Achronim who state that once I closed out a particular deal, and either I made or lost money, but that deal is accounted for, that's a closed deal. And that's a profit, it's a profit, and I have to give my son on it. 3 months from now, I make a different deal, and I lose money on it, one has nothing to do with the other. The common practice does not follow that view. The, you know, the Behuda Paskind, that we can use a more business-like accounting process for this, to evaluate profit and loss. But the Noda Behuda says that's only within one fiscal year. So we have to establish a fiscal year. When's my mice year? When does it stop? And when does it end? What's the beginning and what's the end? Now the truth is, what a person ought to do is probably somewheres about a month, 6 weeks, after he typically finishes with his taxes for the year, that's the best time for the start of fiscal year, to start the new fiscal year, or to end the old fiscal year. Because then the person truly has a handle on what took place. You know, a lot of times, if I'll ask someone in July, well, where are you holding, what's up, what's down, it's very hard to know. I didn't sit there, listen, I don't pay the accountant to send me a report every day. But after one finishes with the taxes, whenever that is, each person pays taxes at different times. I mean, everybody has to pay in on April 15th, but when you finish the paperwork, it can vary from April 15th to October 15th. Now, whenever you finish the paperwork, so usually a month to 6 weeks after that would be a good time to start the Ma'aser Cheshbon. Because that way you know what happened in the past year, you have a way of closing the year before, and to start the new year. So that's the Noda Behuda's view, and this is the common practice, that we establish a fiscal year. And then at the end of that fiscal year, we take a measure of what the profits and the losses and determine ultimately what the bottom line is. Now this also has another very important aspect to it. And what happens? A hot stalker comes. A guy comes and knocks on the door, or a situation that I become aware of, which is really a crying need. And I am convinced through the first-hand knowledge this is really an important stock. I have to get involved. The only problem is that my Meiser account is zero or in the red. Because I had a number of the institutions and big stockers that I do. I just paid them off in the past few months. It's the time of the year that I pay off my major commitments, and I just pay them off. And now this guy, again, this is a really important, I really feel it's an important stock, but I don't have Meiser money on hand. So, can we use what the banking system is? Can I take a cash advance on Meiser? Or not? So this is a pretty hot topic among the Achronim, if you can take a cash advance or not. But certainly if a person establishes at the beginning that he's going to take cash advances, that I will advance money now, which is not Meiser money, and later when I make profit from, I will funnel the money, which is going to stock back into my personal account, that is, if I set it up that way in the first place, that I have a right to do it. There's a whole question of what happens. This was a whole, rather called celebra in the Achronim, that a man made an advance, and then he died. And his children want to, from the estate, to recoup the cash advance. Can they do so or not? And there the Achronim were not so keen. They say it's enough of a chiddush that the guy himself has the right to do it, but that it should carry over to his children. They did not think that that followed. So this is another reason that it's important to have, you know, some cheshbon of what we're doing. And we're making a t'nai, if we make a t'nai at the beginning, so this gives us the flexibility to make a cash advance against future earnings. So this can be very, very important just in managing the flow of tzedakah. Huh? No, I don't think so. I think you could carry this. I believe you could carry from 1 year to the next. I don't see that the limitation should be, as long as you made the condition you're going to do that, I don't see why it should be limited. But again, this is a condition that you have to make when you set the thing up in the first place. Now, how do we evaluate profit and loss? Now, you could say, listen, I'll take out the tax return. I have figures of profit and loss. It's all reduced to some number at the end. I got your Schedule C. It's all spelled out. But in one regard, halacha l'maisa, the halacha is more liberal than the IRS. Goyim know how to be machmer and meikel too, you know. Svisalinsa, when it comes to taking out money, they're very machmer. Other things, you know, between the other mamokim, they can be very meikel. When it comes, you know, collecting taxes, they have a lot of chumras. They, very simple thing. For example, commuting expenses are not deductible except within very severe limitations, according to if you're working more than one place. Listen, you guys know it as well as I do. I don't have to go through it with you. But commuting expenses are very severely limited in how they can be deducted. According to the halacha, there's no one can deduct the commuting expenses. Because any legitimate business expense, there's overhead in the business. I rent a facility, I pay insurance, I pay employees. Getting to the business is also a business expense. I'm not traveling into the city every day. I'm driving 15 miles to Brooklyn because I want to visit Brooklyn or visit Manhattan. You know, if I had a day off, I'd be more than glad to hang around the house in the backyard. So the reason that I'm commuting and I'm putting up with the traffic is because I'm out to make money. So that's a legitimate business expense. I'm spending it only because I'm involved in commercial enterprise. So those expenses can be deducted. Now, similarly, taxes, there are many taxes that can be deducted and taxes which can't be deducted. Those types of taxes which you pay off the top, income tax of all the various sorts. I would suggest even Social Security tax. We'll come back to that later. Those can be deducted. Those are legitimate deductions from MISA. Sales tax is not a legitimate MISA deduction. That's not a business expense. I mean, if it's an expense for the business, I bought something, you know, for the business, then obviously whatever the totality of the expenses is deductible. But what I spent in my personal life, the sales tax is part of my personal expenditures. That's not a business expenditure. And it cannot be deducted from MISA for that reason. Now, there are all varied types of financial situations that a person is involved in. I should stop at this point and just mention, I don't know if I mentioned it in this forum before, in a discussion about Stocko with Ola Yoshev Shtika many years ago, he told me that if you want to be yoy to the mitzvah of Stocko, said, I would propose to you there's only one way to actually be yotzei the mitzvah. And that is to give you money to a gabbai tzedakah who knows the people and the cases that he's actually giving you money to. Knows firsthand. He says, otherwise, he says, I'm afraid you're never going to be yotzei the mitzvah tzedakah. Now, obviously, we could extrapolate a little bit, and that's always what I tell people. When we're talking, we talked last time in the context of Tzedakah about Achzakas HaTorah, supporting Torah institutions. And as I said at this past Shabbos, I am extremely nonpartisan. I have my favorite stalkers as everybody else does, but when I talk about Achzokas HaTorah, I am nonpartisan. What I suggest is that everyone support the yeshivas that they have benefited from, where they personally have studied, where their children have studied, and that are significant parts of the community in which they live. Those should be on the highest level of the institutions that we support. And whichever one that each one support, where in fact his own personal connections are, where he has gained in life, where his family has gained, and let the support go in those directions. But I always tell people, if you want to have the benefit, the schus of Achzokas HaTorah, it should be to institutions that we're 100% sure of where we're giving the money, to what we're giving the money. You know, if I give money to REITs, so I know there are hundreds of guys learning up there every day. If I give money to Lakewood, at the Panovich, over time, in Berlin, I know this is a functioning institution where there are hundreds of people learning every single day. If some yeshiva comes to my door, which I really haven't the foggiest idea, I never heard of it before, I don't know if it exists or doesn't exist, if there are 3 Talmud and there are 1,000, I just don't know. So I cannot be sure what schutzprach, Achzokas HaTorah, I'm going to get. So good. I may want to give them a check, it looks legitimate, support them, help them, fine. But that's not the place to be making our major investments in Achzokas HaTorah. Just as anything else, you know, you can have 100 guys call you telemarketers with all types of deals to invest in. You know, once in a while, one may sound good enough to actually want to play with a few dollars with it and see what happens. But you don't make a portfolio out of those types of investments.
So I have a
song
where Rav Yashiv said, but he said, so all this guy got a handout, and I'm just going to show up and say, no, I don't know you.
So listen, you can give them very minimally. He was very caustic about it. Very caustic about these types of collectors. He looked at me almost in wonder in the discussion. And he said, I don't understand, he said. He says, in the United States, they don't give welfare. He says, even in this country, we give welfare. As I said, well, Yosef advised caution. Okay, we'll leave it at that. I don't want to go further than that. And I'm not on tape and not on the share. You know, but the tenor of his remarks I've already shared with you. You know, as I said, you want to give a small sum things to whoever comes your way, in some regards, it's going to be the table. It gives us chinuch to have rachamim on people. But where should we make our major concerns, our major involvement in Stockholm? We should be quite sure that they're going for causes which are 100% legitimate. It's an age-old problem. Yirmiyahu HaNavi, the Gemara tells us in Baba Basra, how does a tzaddik give a klola? How does a tzaddik give a klola? Could he actually give a klola? Could he want harm to come to somebody? But Yirmiyahu wanted to give a klola. He had tzaynim, and they made enough trouble that they deserved the klola. But how can a tzaddik give a klola? What type of klola is he going to give? So Yirmiyahu's klola to his tzaynim was that when they give tzedakah, they should give it to illegitimate causes. That's the klola that he was able to give.
When it comes to telemarketers, I don't make it up, but you know, a large percentage of the amount of money that you give, is that, so if you give someone $50, do you get credit for $50 in Stockholm, or do you get only if you have to actually those institutions?
No, I believe you get credit for the amount that you gave. I mean, they have expenses. Every institution has expenses. Now, obviously, in some regard, it would seem to be, I'll put it the way Rav Chaim Volozhin put it. There's, to the extent that I have greater impact, so the schus is greater. Here it does vary. The Rav Chaim Volozhin used to relate the following story. Volozhin was the father of all yeshivas, of the Lithuanian yeshivas. So obviously, like all good yeshivas had, the yeshiva had mishalochim collectors that went around and raised funds for the yeshiva to exist. So there was one Lithuanian farmer that used to give a nice donation to the yeshiva every year. And one year came, and he sent away the yeshiva's collector with nothing or barely anything. And Rav Chaim Volozhin was rather puzzled because he'd been a long-term supporter of the yeshiva. So he had occasion to come to the city where the supporter of the yeshiva was, and he went to see him. So he said, what happened? Did you have a downturn in business? He said, no. I'll tell you what happened. He said, the collector for the yeshiva, the mashulach, used to come. He used to march here by foot and walk up to my house. So I saw, listen, the yeshiva's keeping the expenses to a minimum. So I supported the yeshiva. This year, the mashulach pulled up on a coach. So I said, what do I have to do? I have to support the horse too? Yeshiva, I want to support the horse, I have to support. So Rav Chaim Volozhin told him the following. He said, yeshiva has all types of expenses, and they're all part of the yeshiva's expenses. One pays for the lights in the Beis Medrash, one pays for the sforum, one pays the salaries of our shuvas, one pays for the janitor. What does any person's money go to? He says, in Shemayim, that's determined by how much L'Shem Shemayim we give it. If we give it fully L'Shem Shemayim, so in Shemayim they see that it impacts on the greatest Kedusha. If there's a chisaron in all L'Shem Shemayim, so it goes to, has lesser impact. It's all necessary in the totality. But there's a schus that's involved, if we're zoicha, that it's involved in greater Kedusha. And I think Rav Chaim Volozhin's words are apropos for your question too. That we should want to have the greatest impact. And if I'm zoicha to give to a tzedakah, which doesn't have overhead, you sometimes have tzedakahs, for example, that the askonim, those that oversee the tzedakah, bear the entire expenses of the tzedakah from their own personal funds. They pay all the expenses. And the money that comes in goes 100% to tzedakah. They don't touch anything. So if you're zoicha to participate in such tzedakah, you have a bigger schus.
Can you tell us what's saying that this American type, not other measures, but American, they require that 8 or 10 cents a dollar actually go to...
Yeah, so as I say,
expensive.
Right, it's lav kol odem zoicha, you know. So that's part of the wisdom of giving, is to attempt to give in those places and situations which maximize the impact on the real cause that you're trying to support. Yeah, yes, yes, absolutely. A third is a typical price. Listen, all of this you have to take into cheshbon. All of this you have to take into cheshbon.
I came late now because two guys came to my door. You invite them in, you want to treat them with dignity.
100%?
I'm sorry?
100%, you should.
So you have to have them at least give them a chance to tell their story. So the story takes a while. So going back to what the Rosh said, you don't know who to give them after. If you're only going to give them $1 or two, it's not fair to them. Because you're taking up their time.
Listen, so it's very simple. Listen, it's the same as in business. The same thing as in business. If you call a guy comes to your office and you take 2 hours of his time to pitch his product, so you better be serious about wanting to do business with him. If you know you're not going to do business with him, so get rid of him in 5 minutes, in 2 minutes. Well, listen, but you still have to know, you have a certain feeling of what you're able to do, what you're going to do. And you have to act in accordance with that. You know, don't take up his time if you're not going to pay him for his time. Whatever his cause is. Whether it's a business cause or a charitable cause. If I take up his time, I took a half an hour of his time, so I ought to I should be prepared to give him something that's commensurate with that. But so sometimes, listen. Now, listen, in all the life, you're never sure. A guy calls in your business for your company. Do you know that you answered the guy that you were supposed to answer today, you answered, and the guy you're supposed to send away? You just have to operate by your wits. That's all we can do.
You know, in certain communities, I know they do have a park council, they do something like that. They have had a letter from the town itself.
Yeah.
Who legitimizes their ability to stop them
the truth is, the Rabbanon have pitched this around a number of times, but they've been loath in this part of town to get involved in it for a lot of different reasons. And one of them I will describe to you. In Europe, in pre-war Europe, in between the world wars, they established an institution which was called the Vari Yeshivas. And the purpose of the Vari Yeshivas was to raise money for yeshivas collectively. Now, the problem is, with most charitable institutions, they didn't raise as much money as they intended. So the stipends which were supposed to be given to all the various yeshivas, they couldn't cover. So basically, they had to figure out how they're going to cut back on the expenditures. So, who could they ask to pass in such a dinter? They couldn't ask any of the yeshivas in Europe, because they were all nagei avodah. So Reb Chaim Oizer, this was to take place, the Bar Yeshivas is located in Duma. So Reb Chaim Oizer asked the Chazon Ish, he was very tight with the Chazon Ish, and he respected him deeply. So he asked the Chazon Ish should come this and this night to having the meeting, and the Chazon Ish should hear the whole case, and the Chazon Ish should be Machriya, the Chazon Ish should pass him. So the night came, and everyone showed up, and the Chazon Ish didn't show up. He wasn't the type, he didn't forget to show up. So Reb Chaim Oizer said the shliach to him and said, what happened? I asked you to come and you're not here. Oh, he answered Reb Chaim Oizer, he said, since you asked me to undertake this Torah, I started to think what you asked me to do. So what did you ask me to do? You asked me to decide which yeshivas are less worthy. He says, that I'm not prepared to do. That's the problem. Now, I do want to touch, there are a number of issues in terms of Meiser, which are important to know. What happens, for example, with fringe benefits? Start off with fringe benefits. If you work for a corporation or whatever, and they give you fringe benefits. Now, a lot of times fringe benefits you don't see. There's no cash that arrives in my pocket for the fringe benefits. I have a health plan, this type of plan, etc. Am I obligated to give my honor or not? There are those, and they are significant views, that say that something which is merely a fringe benefit, I have no obligation to my son. I do not personally recommend the Chatchila to take that course of action. I think that even on a fringe benefit, the type of fringe benefit, for example, health insurance that I would undoubtedly pay for myself, that I certainly should nice. But it is relevant, I think, in one regard.
So how do you distinguish between the health insurance and the business?
I'm not talking from the standpoint of the employer. From the employer, it's a business expense.
Okay, let's assume the guy is self-employed.
Yeah.
And looking at a Schedule C, and you're saying that the rent thing in the office is okay. Health insurance, it's to the point where it's a necessity. It's not discretionary income.
No, that's true.
Okay, so why?
I'll tell you very simply.
Let me explain. You described at the beginning the necessity.
Okay, I will explain to you what I mean. We don't take off personal living expenses. Now, if you told me, for example, that you bought business interruption insurance, so I would tell you that's a legitimate business expense. Well, what would you do if this year you're not employed? You decided, you know, Richie, enough years in my business being doctor, you know, enough of the grind, that's it. From this year, I'm taking 365 days, I'm closing the practice, I'm taking off this year, that's it. Next year, I'll worry about what I'm going to do. I met a guy once who was an engineer, I think an electrical engineer. His entire life, he worked only from September through June. There came the end of June, he said L'chaim L'shalom to his employer. And he did whatever he wanted for the next 2 months. And he came back in September, and he looked for a new job. And he did this his entire career. And his skills were such that when he would show up at a place, he was well known that whether they needed him or not, they took him. Because they wanted a guy with his skills in the place. And he told me, he says, oh, it was a non-Jewish fellow. He says, I lived my entire life like this. I worked from September through June. The end of June I said so long, came back to the beginning of September and I looked for a new job every year of my life. Now, suppose he decided, Richie, taking the year off. That's it. Whatever. You learn, you tour the world, whatever you want to do, whatever your thing is. Are you going to buy health insurance for this year? So that's so good. So is that a business expense or a personal expense? What I meant to say is the following. I talked about necessities. We want to determine how much money we have really to give to tzedakah. And I'm not talking about what we should deduct them. The question is, what am I capable of giving? So, that was my point at the beginning. What do we need to live? What do I need to live? What I mean to say is the following. I don't mean it as a deduction, but what I mean to say is the following. Suppose, for example, I want to give mice. If I'll give Maisa, I say, I'm not going to cover my bills for the year. Can't pay the expenses. Or Briskerov says, so I'm, to the extent that I have to cut back on Maisa to cover my expenses, I'm potter. That was my point. So I said, how are we going to judge what that is?
So isn't that an effective deduction?
No.
Is there a minimum level of basic needs?
I'm giving on my net. I'm not deducting it. In other words, for example, let's say you make, take any number you want, $200,000 a year, right? Net. So you're talking to give $20,000 a year, it's stock, it's Maisa. Now, it means you have $180,000 to live, are you covering your bills with that?
Yeah.
So fine, you're fine. Let's say I'm making $200,000 a year net. And I'm not gonna, if I give $20,000 to Meiser, I'm not gonna cover my expenses. So, what's the deal? You know, so if you're dealing with a guy that's on the other end of the spectrum, he's making 50 and he wants to give 5 and he might not cover his expenses, that's one type of deal. You know, we might say, listen, at 45, if he's managing somehow to live on that, he probably doesn't have too much fat there. But if I'm spending 180, after tax dollars, 185, 190, and I don't have the 20 to give to Maisa. So that was my point at the beginning. Let's ask ourselves, are we really being upfront with ourselves? That was my point.
Not working as well, that expenditure lies in the
year. Yeah, exactly. So that's what I said at the beginning. We need a little bit to determine, you know, what we're capable of doing. And that is a deduction, but what we're capable of doing, we need to do a certain measure of honesty with ourselves. It's very hard to define. There's no absolute way of defining it. Avachaber, it's also another dimension of how a person perhaps, one yardstick, and again, not absolute. Avachaber, who taught Bali Tshuvas in Eretz Yisrael for many years. So one of his Talmidim became a chassan. So he had the following shayla, a very interesting shayla. He said, I have X amount of money to my name. After that, I'm going to have to go to work. Now, I could rent a normal apartment with normal appliances, and I will be able to learn X amount of time. I could rent myself an old Rishami flat with old-fashioned appliances, and I'll be able to learn X plus amount of time. What should I do? You need the wisdom of Shlomo HaMelech to answer that question. So my friend was rather perplexed. So he decided, listen, what else is he going to do? It's about 30 years back. So he took his Talmud to see Rabbi Yosef, to see what Rabbi Yosef was going to say. That is very interesting. If you've ever been to visit Rabbi Yoshua in his house, you're dealing with a person that had some of his 10, 11 children, who lived, his kitchen only has a mezuzah on the way out, because it doesn't have a shir, really. It's only mechuyav as a knesset in the next room, which is a closed-in porch. The refrigerator is in his bedroom, because there was no other place for it to, in the house for it to fit. So how would such a person evaluate what you're supposed to do? So he gave a very interesting answer. You see, chochma. He said, you should live on the same scale that your friends in yeshiva live. That's the scale you should live on. He felt if you live at a lower standard than that, you're not going to be happy. You won't function. It's also a gauge. It's an insight into ourselves. Now, gifts are normally mechuyev in maisa. Somebody gives me a gift, I'm supposed to give maisa for it. However, there's a very, very important caveat here. That's assuming that the person that gave me the gift gave it to me and it doesn't care what I do with the money. He wants to show me as a token of his friendship or a token of akaras hatov, appreciation for favors that I've done him. So he wants to give me a gift. What I do with it, he doesn't care. It doesn't concern him. Suppose, though, he's giving it to me for a particular reason. You know, a guy's father or his grandfather gives him a gift because he wants him to go to medical school. He wants to be able to learn in yeshiva. So if the son took the money and he traveled to Australia to go around the world, he'd break his head for him. He doesn't want him to do such a thing. So the halacha is that I have to adhere to the wishes of the person that gave the matana. And if he wants me to spend it, he's giving it to me, he says, I gave tzedakah. I'm not interested in your giving, being involved in charitable causes. I'm here to help you so you'll be able to get by the situation that you are in life. Not only am I not mechuyev to give ma'aseh from it, but it's also to give ma'aseh from it. La'vayelit le'sigzom. There's a wondrous gemara in Rosh Hashanah, an awesome gemara. We know that the Kiddush HaChodesh used to take place by physical observation of the beginning of the new lunar phase. Eventually, Chazal phased it out because not having secure electronic communications. So the way we used to communicate the news from Eretz Yisrael to Babel, and it's about 1,100 miles if you check it out on the map, is they had varied hilltops, and they're listed in the Mishnayos and Rosh Hashanah, and they would light bonfires on there, and they would flash it, and in a few hours it would flash all the way from Eretz Yisrael to Babel. The Tztukim and Vaisusim decided to interfere with this, and light fires at false times. So they then instituted that they're going to have overland shluchim, etc. So in the context of all of this, the Tztukim attempted to send false witnesses. So later on, the Chazal instituted that only witnesses whose bona fides have been established before would be accepted for Kiddush HaChodesh. It relates to the following story. A guy shows up with another witness, and they ask him, well, what did you see last night? So basically, to put it in our terms, he basically says to them, well, basically, I saw the cow jump over the moon. That's from, to render it from the Aramaic into the modern context, that's basically what he told them. So they told him, and he said, and just as I saw the cow jump over the moon, that's as much as I saw the moon shine last night. And he asked him, so what are you doing here? He says, well, in the town that I'm in, the Tztukim decided they wanted to shift the Sanhedrin, so they went around and they hired a couple, wanted to hire a couple of guys to give false testimony. So I decided to subvert their cause. So I went to them and said, listen, I'll take the money, I'll go do the job. But I was on the side of the Prushim, I'm not going to help the Tztukim. Right, so I came to Bezdin and I told you that, you know, I blew what happened. So the Gemara says that they allowed him to keep the money that the Tztukim gave him. But for what reason? So Rashi explains, they gave a knas to the Kusim. And Rashi says because of Hefker, Bezdin Hefker, he was allowed to keep the money. What I learned from this piece of Gemara is the following. A guy takes a job as a hitman. Give him $10,000 and go, listen, we don't want this guy around anymore, and that's it. Here's 10 grand and take care of him. On the way, passes the shul, and the lady in the Saras and Dibras, and he hears the Valkyrie, the Kriya, in tone, the Sirtzach. And Epis, you know, I remember something, Epis, that, you know, that I learned once when he was a little kid, that Epis, Ratziha, Lishkin, Shein, Azach, better thing for Jewish boys. How he decides, okay, I can't do this. You know, whatever else I am, I'm a thief, I'm this, or I murder, that's not for me. I will deal with the mafia, that's another problem. But to shy this, undo. So is he allowed to go kill the guy? Absolutely not. What should he do with the money, though? I said, listen, the money for illegitimate causes, their problem, I'm going to keep the guilt. No. Gemara says it's we are even gonna even if he keeps the money. He was given money for a particular purpose. If he doesn't want to live up to that purpose, and maybe morally shouldn't live up to that purpose. There's no right to keep the money. Take it back. Money given to me by someone else for a particular purpose, I can only keep if I live up to what he asked me to do with it. If he asked me to do anything in the world, he's totally immoral. And I become a moral person, I don't want to do it, I have no right to keep the money. A very interesting tshuva in the Igros Moshe. I still can't figure out, every time I think about it, the human dynamics that were involved in this. That escapes me. But what happened was the following. There was a guy that was going to get married, and was going to learn after he got married. So, his father-in-law was a generous fellow, and he gave a hefty nedunya so that his son-in-law should be able to learn. No, his son-in-law was rather a pious fellow, so he decided, whatever, I think it had to do with about 50 grand, and this is quite a number of years back, it was a hefty amount of money, he decided he wants the miser, he got a matan, he's going to miser it. And his future father-in-law told him where he could go. You know, I didn't give you this, I tell you, take 5 grand to give it away to Tzedakah. Now, if I were in that situation, it wouldn't take much convincing to convince me that I better back down, you know. But this fellow was not inclined to back down. So, eventually they agreed that they'll go to Rav Moshe Feinstein and let Rav Moshe decide what's the correct thing to do. So Rav Moshe wrote the following. He said, on the Karen, the 50 grand that he gave him, that he has no right to take Maisa from. He gave him that money so that he should be able to learn. And even if maybe it's more money than he really needs, well, listen, the father wanted his daughter to be comfortable. She shouldn't have to struggle. So he was well endowed. They had deep pockets, and he wanted him to his daughter to live comfortably. So he gave him a lot of money. But he gave it for him to take care of his, you know, to take care of his family, take care of his wife, the man's daughter, and that's what he has a right. He has a right to give it to the stock. He said, however, if the son-in-law now puts the money in the bank or into an investment instrument, and he profits from it, profit is income. Income he has to give Maisa from. That's not the present. That's a very important yardstick. It illuminates, very instructive, of what the responsibility of when we take money from someone, and also about a very important halacha, and also Maisa. For this reason, Rav Moshe Zatzal said that when he gives money to the people in his kailo, he gives it to them solely for them to take care of their own personal living expenses. That's what he gives it to them for. And he spelled out, and therefore he said, from the stipend that I give them for the kailo, they're exempt from Maisa. Because I give them the money. So Rav Shimas do not have lavish amounts of money to give out. You know, if he's giving them the money, it's because he feels this is what's necessary, and maybe even less than what's necessary for him to be able to exist. So he said, I give it for that particular reason, for him to spend for himself. I don't want it to spend for anything else. Yeah?
So when I give money to the Shiva's, my own children, is that the
whole? Oh. Now, we come to the following. There's a basic rule in Maisa. We're not going to finish tonight. We'll finish next week. But let me tell you, this basic rule we'll have time for. I cannot pay my obligations. Obligations meaning my rent, my material obligations, nor my spiritual obligations with Maisa money. And as the Rambam tells us, in Hilchos Talmud Torah, one of the obligations that I have is to teach my children Torah. If that costs me money to do that, so that's my obligation. I can't spend Maisa money to buy Lulav and Esrog. It's a mitzvah. I have to have Lechem Mishnah Shabbos, but I can't spend Maisa money for it. That's my personal obligation. The Moshe Dred really addressed the following. What happens, I don't have the same level of obligation in terms of Talmud Torah for Chinuch Bonus as I do for Chinuch Bonus. So could I deduct the tuition for girls' schools from Maisa? But Rav Moshe was a very astute person. He didn't slip one by him. Very, very astute. And he said, in a society which has laws of compulsory education, so you have to send your daughters to school too. So once you have to send them to school, he says, Al-Pidin, you have no right to send them to a public school. So therefore, he says, when you send them to a girls' school, you are fulfilling an obligation that you have, that you can't send them to public school. You're not sending them, it's because out of the goodness of your heart, you have to send them to school, and Al-Pidin, you can't send them to a public school, so you have to pay. There is a certain corollary of this, and I have to tell you, I've always been deeply disturbed by it. And at times, in fact, they have worked hand in hand with those that have the financial, the fiscal responsibility in yeshivas. I've attempted to help them in this regard. We oftentimes in life, we live in the media age. And in the media age, what's more important is star power rather than substance. And because we live in such a society, it infects the way we look at mitzvahs. We're not untainted by it. So what do I wind up with? Common problem, and everyone that's involved in a yeshiva, that is involved in the financial end of the yeshiva, struggles with this problem. A guy comes in, and we're not dealing, he's not from the few, the upper crust of the community financially. Well, it's a normal average guy, somewhere in the middle. It's, you know, he works hard and he struggles to pay his bills and support his family and do what he's supposed to do. And he gets by, but you know, he's not, there's no big bucks hanging around him. Comes to the yeshiva and he says, listen, I can't spend my money for tuition. Moshe said, you can't. Whatever, Allah is like that, fine. If I give you all that you're asking of me, I won't have any money for tzedakah. I want to give Maisa. So I can't pay you all the money you're asking of. This is what goes on. So I've had people that have financial responsibility for yeshivas come to me. And I told them what I thought. And I said, I'm willing to tell it to anyone that wants to know. I said, first and foremost is the obligation to support the schools that our children attend. If I'm able to pay it without using Maisa money, so then I'm obligated to do so. If I'm not able to pay all that's expected of me without using Maisa money, then the place that Maisa money has to go to is to the schools which are educating my children. It doesn't belong in a school on the other end of the world. Because whatever, it's nice to be a patron of some yeshiva, whatever. I would like to be a patron of Ponovitz Yeshiva, of Mir Yerushalayim, you know, why not? Where 5,000 guys are learning every day at Lakewood. It's very nice, it's a good feeling. But that's not my obligation. My first obligation is to the schools which educate my own children. So if I'm able to pay the tuition and I have my money left beside, so good, I'll tell you my arm, use it, send some to your local schools, send some to other yeshivas, fine. But if I can't meet the basic obligation, and the reason that I can't meet it is I want money from Maisa, so good. So take that Maisa and give it to his child school. That's the first place that it belongs. I will tell you that Rav Henoch Leibowitz, my Rebbe, the Rosh of Chofetz Chaim, his particular view on this, and as I told someone tonight, if we would accept half of what he says, we would be doing very well. And he tells his Talmidim that he feels that the obligation to the yeshiva that you learn them, wherever that is 50% of your Maisa money. So as I told someone today, if we live up to half of that, we'll also be doing well. But it gives us a certain feeling, there's an achrayus that we have. You know the famous story that the Gemara relates of the man that was planting the boxa tree. So they came to him and they said, what are you planting a boxa tree for? You're an old guy. By the time this thing is ever going to give fruits, your children won't be here. You'll be lucky if your grandchildren have it. What in the world are you out to do? You know, do something that you're going to benefit from. But you're doing something of such long-term significance at your age. So he said, gentlemen, there's a certain morality that's involved. And that is, I came to the world and I found it with these trees. I have a certain obligation to posterity to see that they come to a world which has this too. And Rabbi Yisrael, that's part of our obligation too. We went 30 years back, 40 years back, whatever it is, we went to yeshiva. That yeshiva existed because there are people, some that are still here and many that are not here, that struggle to make those yeshivas exist. They dug into their pockets, they paid the bills, and they made it happen. We have that same moral obligation. Our obligation for the institutions that we personally have studied in, our children study, which benefit the communities in which we live, which Baruch Hashem, if we live in an age where we have an expectation that someone has children, that his children are going to grow up and stay from, it's because Baruch Hashem, our Torah Chinuch is successful. It didn't happen by accident. It doesn't happen for free. And it's part of our obligation to the posterity, to the future, to see that it remains vibrant, strong, dynamic, and grows stronger. And one final thing, and with that I'll end for today. I have a lot more to say about mice, but I want to end with this for today. Part of the misapprehension of our obligations concerning supporting Torah institutions is we feel, listen, as long as my child is in this school, so it's my obligation. But life went forward now. You know, I don't have a kid in elementary school. I don't even have a kid in high school anymore. You know, my kids are married already. My grandchildren, whatever, they live somewhere else. What's my connection? The Rambam tells us in Hilchos Talmud Torah that the obligation to have a yeshiva is not the obligation per se of the parents, it is the obligation of the city. And the Ratunas Chois in the Chazal, and the Mefarshei Rambam say that they are both true. One states that a city which doesn't have a Talmud Torah, which doesn't have a place to educate its children, is Machrim and Isa, you put it in Chayrim. And there's a second version which says Machrim and Isa, you have to destroy it. So the Mefarshei Rambam say that they are both true. If they have an established yeshiva, the first thing we're supposed to do if we have the power is to threaten them, we're going to put them in Chayrim until they establish a yeshiva. And if we put them in Chayrim and that doesn't help, if we have the power, then we're supposed to come Ala Sharon, and that's it. And just tell them we're evacuating the place. That's it. The place is closed, you know. Just everyone there, pack them up and send them out. You can't stay here anymore. Same, it has to be a shul. There has to be a mikvah. There has to be a place to teach Torah. It's an obligation, a municipal obligation. It's not only an obligation of the parents. If we live in a city, I never had a child that went to school there alone. I have no children. It makes no difference. I grew up on the other end of the world. I'm 73 years old. I have no connection. My children never came to this. I live here. I share in the obligation to maintain its institutions. I'll end with one thing for today. One story. It's an amazing story. This is circa 1930 this happened. About 75 years ago. There was a very wealthy man who lived in Chicago. And he was the dinner chairman. Hebron Yeshiva had a dinner in Chicago in those years. And he was the chairman of the dinner. And he gave enormous tens of thousands of dollars in the 20s to the yeshiva. In the crash in 1929, he lost all his money. He had been fabulously wealthy, and he was left to live in a basement. He had nothing left to his name. The Rosh Yeshivas came to town. And he said, I want to be dinner chairman this year again. And they were a little beside themselves. How could you take a guy who's down and out to make him dinner chairman? But they couldn't say no to him. He had helped them so much in the 1920s that if he wanted it, they had to give it to him. They didn't know what's going to happen. Comes the night of the dinner, and he goes up on the podium, and he says, Rabbi Yisrael, let me tell you. You know, I was once a very wealthy man. And he says, you know, that row of houses in Chicago, I used to own it. He says, over there, there's a factory. I used to own that. He says, that business there, I used to own. And he started enumerating all the businesses that he owned in Chicago. He says, today, he says, I lost it all, as you know. I don't have any of it left. He says, but you know what I have? There's one thing that I still have to my name. He says, all the money that I gave to Chevron Yeshiva in the 1920s, he says, that's the one thing I still have to my name. Nothing else. I lost the rest. Good night, brothers.